And when I think about it, it was a little bit crazy. I was 34 years of age when I got this promotion, and I think that probably was a big risk the company took on me. And the way Guidant was, people believed in you and wanted you to be successful. So you, that's a good pressure in you wanting to do your best because people believe in you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. Today, we have Beverly Huss, who is the president and CEO of Cool Therapeutics. That's cool, but Q. Beverly has years of experience as a leader in medtech. Previously, she led Vibrant, a device company that treats morbid obesity. And before that, she held many executive roles at Guidant, starting in 1986 as an engineer and taking on position of increasing responsibility. Ultimately, she managed a worldwide endovascular solution business as president. And in 4 years, she quadrupled worldwide revenues for the carotid and peripheral vascular business to $150 million. Beth has lots of insight to share about companies large and small, as well as some great advice on how to approach investors and partners in the Chinese market. I hope you enjoyed the talk. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast in iTunes. Welcome, Beth. Thanks for coming and joining me here at UCSF campus at Mission Bay today. For a starter, I thought when I was looking at how your career start, you started out as an engineer. You did your undergraduate in engineering, and then you do metallurgical engineer, nothing in healthcare. And can you tell us how you get into healthcare from doing metallurgical and then defense system as well?
Surely. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here with you. So I originally wanted to be a veterinarian and was putting myself through school and didn't quite have the money to be a vet and decided that I liked science and math, so I'd be an engineer. And that sort of came from my mother telling me at a very young age to pick a male-dominated career and excel at it so that I could always take care of myself. So I when you think about it, in 1964, that was really good advice. So I worked in the steel industry first because I wanted to be a primary metallurgist, a primary materials engineer, and I did that for a few years. And then I worked in defense because I wanted to try something new. And then my husband got a call to for his company, Weyerhaeuser, moved to the Bay Area. And so my choices were to be in defense again, working with Ford Aerospace, or to go to work for a little company called Advanced Cardiovascular Systems, which at the time was about 700 employees. And I had met Susan Norton, a colleague, in a quality management class, and she recruited me. And in those days, there weren't a lot of metallurgical engineers, material scientists, and they needed a guide wire engineer. So after about 2 weeks of being in class with her, she recruited me, and about a month later, I was at ACS, and I told Ford Aerospace, no, I think I'm going to move to healthcare where I'll be saving lives versus making products that do the opposite. Yeah, that whose claim to fame is to kill and maim when you work on ammunition and things like that. So that's how I found ACS, and I loved it because wherever I worked before, I was the lone female engineer, and I was sort of an anomaly. Something interesting that my colleagues kind of observed, but at ACS there were so many female engineers that I just fit in, and it was fabulous. It was, you were one of the crowd. You weren't something special or different.
Yeah.
So, so I absolutely loved it. I thought it was so interesting to work on things for interventional cardiology, to stand in a room with a doctor and know how your product behaved right away because they would give you the feedback while you were standing there. And I just, my husband used to say to me that he thought, you know, I had little ACSs in my blood because all of us, well, really all of us, because we loved the company so much and we loved what we were doing.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people who graduate from ACS and then become Guidant later right. on. And right. I know you're one of the women, the women in Guidant. And I think the Guidant produce a lot of leaders in this field. And tell us a bit more about your experience, because you work at Guidant for much longer compared to when you're in the steel industry and the defense industry, obviously. You
right.
love it.
Right.
And what made you stay?
Well, I think I worked at Guidant for 20 years, and I think what made me stay, first of all, was the people that worked there, what we were doing, sort of this always striving to make the best product, to meet something that the physician, that the patient didn't have. And it was so exciting to be sort of on this forefront of technology, sort of making the way of how to do this at the time. We didn't have things like the Roseman Institute. We didn't have things like Stanford Biodesign. We kind of had to figure it out as we went. And so that made it very exciting. And then, again, just the people. There was always this striving to be the best, to sort of outdo ourselves in product development, in the way we brought something to the clinic, in the way we worked with FDA. And you always felt like there was this group of really high integrity people working really hard on this. We didn't always agree. We had disagreements. We had tough times. But I can honestly say that I always felt that my colleagues and peers and team members were working to really do the best thing in the best way. And so that made me stay 20 years.
Yeah. So you started in as a quality engineers, and then you move away from that field. Can you tell us more about what prompted you to move that?
So I actually started as a guide wire engineer in the process plant, and then I had a position where at bringing new products from R&D into the pilot plant and getting them to market. And then I had a position where I worked in our Temecula facility, bringing products from R&D into full-scale manufacturing. That really helped me understand the difference between an R&D mentality and a manufacturing mentality. And then we decided as a company, the management of ACS decided we were going to do entrepreneurial ventures so that we would take our technology to new markets. And we started a group called Peripheral Systems Group for peripheral angioplasty. And I got to run R&D, regulatory and quality in that group. And then got promoted to director of the first drug-eluting stent, and then from that, VP of the coronary stent group. And when I think about it, it was a little bit crazy. I was 34 years of age when I got this promotion, and I think that probably was a big risk the company took on me. And the way Guidant was, people believed in you and wanted you to be successful, so you... That's a good pressure in you wanting to do your best because people believe in you. So we brought the Multilink stent to market, the Multilink Duet under my leadership. We went from 15 people to 400. We became a $1 billion business, the profit engine for the company. And then I went to the field. I ran Canada and Latin America, so I had to put all my technology background aside, and really that is about building teams, motivating people, developing relationships with customers in two different cultures. A lot of people think Canada's like the U.S. It's really not. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more socialist style of medicine. Latin America is a bunch of different markets. Our biggest market was Brazil. So really learning how to work in different cultures with different kinds of people and motivate them to make their sales numbers, launch new products. So that was a huge growth experience for me. And then I came back and I was a division president of Endovascular Solutions and had to clean up a Department of Justice investigation on the AnCure product, very tough times, mm-hmm. while at the same time build the carotid and the peripheral business. And so that was probably the most challenging time of my career.
What makes it so challenging?
Well,
DOJ is always tough.
Yeah. But. So I came into the job happy to be promoted to division president, but presented with two audits that were pretty awful. Quality audits of this AAA implant business. And so we had to figure out everything that was wrong, what would be the cleanup plan, inform FDA, and we ended up pulling the product from the market and not relaunching it until we had filed PMA submissions, filed medical device reports that hadn't been filed, and terminating a lot of management. And we got through it, and then there was a Department of Justice investigation that the company ended up paying fines for. And so sometimes it's hard when you're the cleanup act. People don't always remember that, but it really showed me again that there were good people in the company that rose to the occasion to, you know, and we had to lay people off, we had to let people go. That really rose to the occasion to correct what had been done. And then we ended up exiting that business and building the peripheral vascular and carotid business, and we were first to get a carotid stent to market. We beat J&J. So a lot of struggles the first probably 2 years I was in that position cleaning that up, and very challenging times. A lot of news coverage. Yeah, a lot of challenging times.
Yeah, so. I mean, what do you learn from that? And, you know, something that, you know, lesson learned, what to do and not to do in that situation that you can apply in your startup world right now?
I think that what you learn is you're never as good as your good press, and you're never as bad as your bad press. And so you kind of have to keep your head focused on what's really important and not let some of those outside forces affect you, which is really hard. And then in the end, it's all about being very honest with people. I mean, to tell people that you're going to shut a portion of the business down and let a couple hundred people go is not easy. But even some of the people we let go, and, you know, we gave them good exit packages, but still we upset their lives, right? And some of those people will come back and say, I appreciated your honesty. It helped me start something new in my career. And so I think that, again, speaks to the integrity of the people that were there. But it was a pretty challenging time.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of the people who graduate from ACS time, they still like close together. So it shows that it's a good place to be. And then, of course, Guidant got sold to Eli Lilly. So do you join there, or do you that's when you decide to start?
So actually, Lilly bought ACS before my time, but Guidant was going to be sold to J&J and then eventually Boston Scientific. And after we launched the carotid stent, I thought, you know, I would like to go and be an entrepreneur. So I took some time off. I actually consulted with the company and helped with the diligence process with Boston Scientific. So I took a little bit of sabbatical and did some board work and some consulting. And then I decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I ran a company in the obesity space called Vibrant and really loved being an entrepreneur. And now my most recent company is in the therapeutic hypothermia, cooling, and exercise recovery space. And it's called Cool Therapeutics, but cool with a Q, not a C.
Right. Tell us more about the Vibrant experience you have. I mean, you have successfully raised over $60 million for that particular enterprise and from, you know, prestigious ventures, NEA, Delphi, and TPG. And the environment is so different now versus back then. And then you also have to do an asset sale. So can you tell us about what happened and what you learned from it?
Sure. So Vibrant, another great team of people, great investors, especially NEA and Delphi. And so we had an implant that would have been competition for the lap band. And it was we called it a paragastric implant that fit on top of the stomach to fill the space the stomach would expand into. And it was sutured to the front part of the abdominal wall in a very quick 20-minute laparoscopic procedure. And it could be filled. It was filled with saline. It actually looked like a bean-shaped implant. And we got approval in Australia. We did about 100 patients in Australia, and we got the CE mark. And we were working very diligently in 2010 to get an IDE study and start a PMA clinical trial here in the U.S. because the U.S. is the, unfortunately, we're the most obese country in the world, percentage-wise, followed by Australia. And there wasn't a big market in Europe or Australia for us to really only have those markets as a means to launch the product. So the U.S. study would have been probably a 2 to 3 year study at a cost of $35 million. And this was at a time when it was very difficult to raise money. A lot of other devices in the space had failed. And so the decision was made by the investors to sell the IP and to close the company, which is a shame. We had 66 patents issued. And we had a product that worked, but the environment was just so negative, one, for raising capital, and two, in the obesity space, because so many others had failed.
Yeah, so it, that must be tough, because you see how it all got started, and you have to unwind them.
Yeah.
And what's the outcome of that experience for you personally?
So for me, I would say the biggest outcome is, as I think about technologies, is how to de-risk them with in such a way that you're very capital efficient. If you can get a technology to market and profitable in $40 to $50 million in a big market, you're probably going to have a nice exit for investors. And so as much as you can do to be capital efficient, you should do. And it's not to say we weren't capital efficient at Vibrant, we were, but to get that product to market would have been well over $100 million. And it gets really hard for investors to make money in the device space when you have over $100 million in. So I would say the biggest thing for me is to be capital efficient, to assure that, you know, our regulatory strategy isn't moving. When we were working on our product, the FDA had a really hard time sort of, it was going through that transition with the 510K issues and, you know, really getting, it took us a year to get confirmation of exactly what the primary endpoint would be in the clinical trial. And in working with FDA to learn that there are a couple things you may need for your study and your company to be successful, and you focus on those with FDA, and then the other things that they ask you for, you give them freely, willingly, you kind of cross them off the list up front, including extra testing. And so we had a great relationship with FDA, but it was a very challenging time from a regulatory perspective and a fundraising perspective.
Yeah. I think you're not alone.
No. And it's a shame because the product worked. You know, we had patients who wrote us letters, lost over 100 pounds, sent us their before and after pictures. And, you know, weight and physical activity and interpersonal relationships that come with that weight loss are very personal to all of us. So it's hard to not be affected by that, that you're really affecting somebody's life. We had a patient who wrote to us and said, "I couldn't get behind the wheel of my car. Now I can. I didn't fit physically. I couldn't run after my children. Now I can. I couldn't go into a store and buy a regular size. Now I can." And, you know, that's affecting somebody's life. So you feel very good about that.
Yeah. This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based med tech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into a unique healthcare solution. For more information, visit their website at iolifescience.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com. So do you still follow this patient? Do they still have your device in place?
I don't know if they do. We provided, I feel very good about how we exited that company in that we did not owe any vendors or clinical sites payments. We took care of the patients. We said, if you want to keep the device, you can keep it. If you want to have it removed because it was removable, we'll pay for the removal. And that's a tribute to our investors who stood behind us and did the right thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they still have it. We don't keep in touch with the patients. They used to write anonymously to us. Mm-hmm. As a company, so I don't know whatever happened to those patients. I do know that we had many that did very, very well. So it was a shame the product didn't come to market.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, obesity is still an issue. Do you think, the patent is still there, but probably is, life is, the clock is ticking too. Do you think there's any chance this might be brought back to it's live again?
Oh, I would love to see that because the product work, I don't know if it will be brought back. I mean, I think we would probably have to be far enough out that the LPs of the venture firm sort of forget, have amnesia about how difficult the obesity space is. But I do think it's such a huge problem for the U.S., and it's a multifactorial disease. And then there are all these comorbidities, heart disease, high blood pressure, cancer, polycystic ovarian disease. I mean, the Cleveland Clinic has a great poster of all the comorbidities head to toe on obesity. So I feel like, my grandmother, my Italian grandmother was morbidly obese. I feel like it's such a big problem that we need lots of solutions and that hopefully FDA will, and I think they have, get a little bit more friendly to the regulatory path for these devices and therapies because no one thing is going to solve this, and we need lots of solutions for this.
Yeah. Isn't there a lot of people selling all this snake oil to people to lose weight?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, Christine. A lot of it is snake oil, and you have to realize that any device or even drug in the obesity space is a tool that helps the patient get control of this problem. Right. It's not like drug addiction or alcoholism. You can live without taking a drug, you can live without alcohol, but you can't live without eating. And you have to give the patient a tool to work on their eating and to getting this problem under control. So whatever drug, device, whatever, it's always going to be a tool for them, and they have to work on it at the same time. They have to be at the right sort of point in their disease, and it is a disease to want to work on it.
Right. Yeah. It's a tough space. And
Very tough.
Definitely you need a tool. It's not something that you can do it on your own.
No, it's hard.
Yeah. So from that exercise, you still think the startup is the place where you want to be. That's you are doing the cool therapeutic. Tell us more about that.
So I am a lover of bringing these wonderful technologies forward that are exciting, building teams, working with patients and physicians. And so our founder, Amir Belson, Amir is a serial entrepreneur, pediatric nephrologist. We had become friends, my husband and I, with he and his wife. And he had been after me to run this company called Thermacure at the time. And I said, okay, well, let me do the diligence a venture capitalist would do. And if I believe in the technology and I think there's a market, I will come and be the CEO. So after a few months, I agreed. And essentially what we do is cool patients through the lungs by delivering frozen saline particles. The lungs have a big surface area, about half the size of a tennis court, about 70 square meters. And they're a great heat exchanger, because you cool the lung and then the blood that goes to the lung to get oxygenated gets cooled and then it goes to the heart and the brain first, so you cool those organs first. So I thought it was an ingenious idea. Amir, in his way, files lots of patents and then sort of sits and waits for a market to grow. It's another area where a few companies have been successful with exits, but not a lot. And my big belief there is that it's because there hasn't been a great solution here. So we have cooling catheters, cooling pads, but none of them are sort of non-invasive, rapid to cool, and fit into the flow of care. And so we have this whole hospital business for using this in neurosurgery, vascular surgery, stroke, ST segment, MI, traumatic brain injury. But then we also have a consumer application as well for athletes where we can cool down athletes. So that's what I think makes us very different. And our animal data look really good, and we're getting ready to go to our first in-human study, so it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, so now you're raising the funding in completely different environment than when you used to be at Vibrant. Yeah. And I mean, tell us more about that.
So our investors are very different. One of the things that I saw, not at this Wilson Sonsini conference, but the one after JP Morgan, is that investors now tend to be international. So a lot of Chinese investors, family funds, non-dilutive capital, hospital groups, and I'm missing one. And so of that four or five, we have Chinese investors, Beijing Joint Medical. We have a family fund, TAMCAP, that has come in and supported the company from the early days. We have about 65 individual angel investors, people who are physicians, executives, who know us, who the average investment was maybe $90,000 or $100,000. And we have $3 million in non-dilutive capital from the U.S. Army Defense Innovation Unit that supported our early research. And I think of the $3 million now, they paid us about $1.5 million. And they actually put us on their website. And so this was a financing group created by the former Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, $200 million for startup companies in cybersecurity, in healthcare, in defense. And we, through our network, were connected with some folks that got us into that. Well, once they put us on their website, then the doors kind of opened for investors.
Okay.
So, and that's not something they told us they were going to do. In fact, we couldn't talk a lot about it until they put us on their website.
I see.
So that was sort of, that made some of the dominoes fall for us. It's still hard to fundraise, but we have a different group of investors now than we did at Vibrant. And I think the reason for that is because venture capital firms, unless it's their own incubator, don't often invest until after first in human. So I think as an entrepreneur, you have to be scrappier about who you go to for investments. And we are blessed in that, you know, we had a Chinese advisor, Dr. Jiang Feng, who brought us Beijing Joint Medical, another contact Brooke guy that helped us learn to work with a Chinese investor. And they've come in the Series A and this recent convertible note, and then TAMCAP as well, and several of our other individual investors. But it's a very different group than, you know, having a big VC firm like NEA or Delphi or TPG. And we have to be, I think, even more respectful entrepreneurs because, you know, people write us checks from their
personal
wealth, and we feel very, we always felt accountable, but we feel very accountable. We update them quarterly on what's happening. We up them on our data, our spending, our milestone achievement, all those things. And I think it makes you even more respectful of people believing in the technology and the team and the people.
Yeah, so that's great. So you know, you definitely hear a lot more Chinese investors. You see them really interested in the medtech space. What kind of advice that you can give for people? Because there's so many, you know, the news is not helping either when everybody's saying that the Chinese is trying to steal everything away from you. And how do you know which investor to work with? And how do you work with them? You've done it well, and if you can share that insight.
I think you need a really good contact in China and someone who understands our culture and Chinese culture. And I think our two contacts there really helped us with that. I think that you have to be very patient as an entrepreneur because I think, you know, Chinese investors sometimes don't move at the same pace as a US VC might. You have to be a clear communicator. We have to do a lot of our meetings with a translator. And I've learned not to use analogies, to be more clear and direct in how I describe things to avoid confusion. And then usually if you have a Chinese investor, they're going to want some access to the technology, either through distribution or manufacturing for the Chinese market. And especially for us, therapeutic hypothermia is very underpenetrated in China. So that's the biggest market opportunity in the world. So I think you have to realize that going in, that you may have to give away distribution or manufacturing for that market, and then you protect yourself with IP. We have Cool has 33 issued and I think 19 pending patents now, and we have a lot of patents in Asia, in China, in Japan, in India, and so I think that helps us. And by having a partner there that's going to distribute this, they want to make sure, you know, their priorities and motivations are the same as ours. They want to make sure the technology works well and that it's protected. And so I think that's helpful. And, you know, the answer is we're on this journey with them and we don't know how it's going to work out. And it's just day by day doing what we say we're going to do and building trust and keeping them informed. And, you know, they come here for our board meetings and having Amir and I go to China. We just spent 6 days in Beijing with them and developing relationships with other investors. You know, at the end of the day, people do things for people. And when you come to them and spend time with them and talk with their experts about the technology, you know, I think you build a working relationship, right? Just like anywhere else.
Right. So you mentioned about different culture. How is it different? I mean, now you've worked with them long enough. What are the obvious one that you didn't think about?
I think negotiation of deal terms is probably not as straightforward in China as it is here. Sometimes you think you have a deal and you may not, and you have to go back and negotiate a term. I think that our investors, we are their second healthcare investment. Having them understand FDA is important because you know that you meet with FDA and you negotiate the clinical trial, the testing, and that is a process that evolves over time. And until you put your submission in, you don't definitively know. I think that's new for them. And so helping them understand that is important. I think helping them understand that you build a syndicate around the lead coming in. Mm-hmm. And when you do a follow-on investment, if the existing investors come in, that gives other investors confidence and they'll come into the deal. So I think helping them understand culturally how those things are here has really helped. I have to give them a lot of credit for the time they spent with us and trying to learn that and understand that I think is important.
Well, that's great. It's encouraging because I think, you know, there's two faction of people who take Chinese money or no Chinese money. Changing the topic a little bit, I mean, your experience at a large company now in a startup, like what kind of things that you learn from your corporate world that translate really well to the startup world and then something that you can kind of leave behind for a big corporate world that you should not bring into startup world.
Yeah. So I think I always tell the students I mentor that are early in their career to go to a big company to learn how to do things properly, to learn how to document your design for IP properly, to do the regulatory part properly, the quality part, the clinical trial part, manufacturing, to learn all those things in a big company. And so doing things right is the way you learn it from a big company. But in a small company, you have to be scrappy. If your timeline's delayed, you have to figure out how to make up the time, how to make up the cost. And I was having this conversation with one of our engineers the other day, and he said, you know, in a big company, a milestone's kind of a goal, but it's flexible, but it's not in a small company. And my advice to him was, throw that part of a big company away. Don't think about that anymore and think about, this is the milestone. How are we going to effectively get here? We have to dot all of the I's and cross all the T's. We'll never go forward unless things are right. But how do we do that at the lowest cost, the fastest way we possibly can, and how do we help each other? And it's always in a startup and all hands on deck, right?
Right.
It doesn't matter if you're the CEO. You may throw out the garbage or help with an animal study or whatever it takes. And so that part's, I think, different in a small company. But I also think it's a lot of fun because you know in a small company, if something you've done that day is actually moved the things forward, where in a big company, you might say, did it happen because of something I did or did it happen in spite of me, right? So I think in a small company, it's much more immediate feedback and, you know, a lot of struggles and a lot of euphoria when things go well. And that's why I said you can't always, you know, you're not as good as your good press and you're not as bad as your bad press. You kind of have to find the middle ground. So I think that makes it very different. So.
Yeah. Okay. Last question, the fun question I always throw in just... it helps my book reading. What books are you reading this summer or this year that you think that you can recommend? And why do you like it?
Well, I read Red Notice, which I loved, about the guy that got the Magnitsky Act passed. And I really loved it because it gave me insight into a culture that was very different. I recommend that book a lot. I have to say I haven't read a lot of books this year because of my travel schedule and work schedule. I want to read AI for Dummies and learn more about that. And then I just saw on 60 Minutes a book by, I think the man's name is Ka-Fu Lee, on artificial intelligence. So I'm pretty interested in that. And where it's going to be in my lifetime. I'm, you know, going to be 60 next year. Where's it going to be in my lifetime? And how's it going to affect healthcare? So yeah. I want to read that as well.
Yeah. That's on my list.
Yeah.
So, okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.